Thanks for listening to On Security, conversations with the world's leading security experts, part of the On Podcast Network. For more information, visit us at informit.com/podcasts.
So basically, what is, we've got people dying, we've got software that makes cars stall, we've got cell phones that could be hacked. It's like, how much more, we have enough proof, and your book goes, gives story after story from basically every type of technology, every industry, every permutation out there. But, it's 2008, and as we speak, I'm sure, thousands of line of insecure code has been, been written. So, what is it going to take to, to turn this, turn this around, not even turn around, just, get a basic awareness saying, hey, this has to stop.
Well, I think this has to stop message or that sentiment is being felt by more and more people. I know that DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, that's their stance. Their stance for, I can't speak for them, but their stance, as far as that I can tell, is that this needs to stop and something needs to change. So that's a governmental body acknowledging that there's an issue here. But there's also the issue of, well, does the population really care enough? And what type of event or what type of message would need to be injected into the media such that people become aware of it? Well, that's a more difficult question to answer. There are certainly people who understand the severity of the issue, but the issue we also have with technology and software in particular is the nature of the conversation that's being had around it. If you look at, movies like The Net, or if you look at, movies that either praise or denigrate hackers, however it might be, it's still seen as, it's still seen kind of as an immature threat. That is, people know it's kind of a problem, but they really can't always place it directly into their life. Yeah, sure, their cell phone might misbehave, their laptop might crash here and there, their word processor might go kaflooey, but they've come to tolerate that type of misbehavior or defect on the part of their software. And to some, they say, oh, it's just the cost of doing business. To others, if their word processor, collapses right when they're, writing up a proposal or doing something, it's much more critical. So what we have in the consumer space is what's called an inconsistent valuation. And what that means is that people value software differently for the task that they're using it. You may have a generic operating system, but if you're running a real-time system or running just your word processor, your expectations are a little bit different, but it's still a commodity product that's put out into the stream of commerce. Now it's up to the people to figure out what type of reliability they need from it. As a manufacturer, it's very difficult to build a product that's all things for all people. And most of the operating system vendors have done actually a fairly good job of creating a product that can be used by a lot of people. But so that's focusing on the good, okay? Because we couldn't build the type of IT systems we have today. We couldn't do the types of things we did if software didn't meet some threshold of quality. So the question is it good enough? Well, it's good enough from one perspective, that is usability. The other perspective, however, is much more difficult to illuminate because of the inconsistent valuation that people have primarily around security. And when it comes to security, the U.S. government has certain security requirements that are far different than the mom-and-pop shop down in Florida, perhaps. But here's the key issue. The key issue is that software is connected to a network, which means even small inconsistencies in the level of security people feel they need individually has an effect on the whole for the neighborhood. And your neighborhood is, when you connect it in the internet, you're in a global neighborhood immediately. That means anyone in Ukraine or Brazil can reach out for you the minute you connect. So that has consequences for us all. So as a manufacturer, we all admit, I think, in the security profession that it is difficult to create a general purpose operating system. However, at the same time, we have to ask ourselves, how much are we going to tolerate inconsistencies or defects in an operating system or in an application or in a website for which anyone in the world can reach out to and potentially exploit if there's a vulnerability in it? So from that perspective, we have a difficult time of responding correctly in the market from a consumer perspective. which means the activities on part of DHS and other governmental bodies is very beneficial because it can act as a clearinghouse for information that the government can say, okay, this is a baseline security that we want. Whatever that baseline might be, they can say, okay, we're going to do this. But fundamentally, without any true accountability on the software manufacturers, they have insufficient incentive to follow it. Now, that's a very, I think, a controversial statement to make, simply because any software manufacturer will say, well, hey, you know, we do our best to create the best product we possibly can. And the response might be, yeah, but your best isn't good enough. Because even small foibles in software manufacturing can result in global consequences. In fact, an insecure piece of software that's connected to the network immediately has global consequences if there's multiple replicants of that software running around on people's desktops, or if anyone in the world can access that website. You know, so if you're talking about software as a service, that's just as a lucrative a target, because now you've got all these crown jewels in a database sitting behind a single web interface. And my gosh, if that isn't tempting. And of course, having millions of desktops that are vulnerable is just as tempting. So you have a certain market, external market stimulus that needs to be put on there to kind of stabilize or to standardize the expectation of security across the population. Again, we can return to the auto manufacturing example. We have a 5-star rating on vehicles. That means you have a spectrum of risk that as a consumer you can choose from. You can say, I don't care what ratings I have. You know, I'll buy a 3-star. I don't care. Now, the good thing about this is that 80 to 90%, actually over 90% of the cars now have a 4-star rating or higher, which means the market has really chosen to say that we're really only going to tolerate 4- and 5-star rated vehicles for the most part. So you might say, oh, I'll tolerate a 3-star rated vehicle, but the market has chosen to elevate the number of cars in the market to 4- and 5-stars because that's what sells. So you actually get a free ride, so to speak, because other people have chosen better security. You get it even though you might not care. So that's a good thing. And that's a very beneficial thing for anybody in the space. With software, we have no type of visualizing the level of security or safety we get out of it, which means it's very difficult for people to price or to accept the level of risk by purchasing. You have no spectrum. The minute you purchase it, you may be buying wonderfully high-quality secure software. You may not be. The problem is you don't know until it's too late. So one of the things when we start talking about trying to the things that we can do to address the issue is, of course, making the issue of safety or in cybersecurity, the cybersecurity itself, more visible to the marketplace so that people can choose. But really, that's not going to happen without some type of external market impetus, which is to say, okay, all software that gets sold in the United States or California or Florida must be, you know, rated to some level. And that's just one potential way of addressing that.
You talk about, you know, that rating. I mean, it's the gold the gold standard for rating in general is Consumer Reports. But you know, it's Consumer Reports themselves say there's a few products they can't review, and one of them is mattresses, and it's because is that. There's so every mattress vendor maker, you know, has all these different combinations, and so when you can't buy the same mattress at two different stores, and that's why they've always got these sales, and they say, you know, if you find a mattress cheaper, the same mattress cheaper, we'll give it to you for free, and it's an absurd claim because it's by very definition impossible to do it because. You know, they've got the loan distribution, but with that, you know, is there a potential to have a Consumer Reports for software security? I mean, is that something we could see, you know, 5 years down the line?
You know, I think 5 years down the road is probably very optimistic. What we can, whatever it might be, whether it's Consumer Reports or an NHTSA like a rating, whatever we might decide on, it needs to make security visible. That is, people, if it's important to them, it's visible so that they can price it. They can say, well, I want 5-star, I want 4-star. Now, of course, the issue you get into is just like mattresses, there's a lot of software that's created custom or might appear custom to a certain extent. So you can get a mattress just like you can get an operating system, but comparing Linux against, you know, Windows, or comparing, you know, Sealy against or against another mattress. I'm drawing a blank on other mattress vendors all of a sudden, but you know, you
Tempur-Pedic.
Can say, well, Tempur-Pedic, you know, you're comparing apples to apples. There's no way to find, you know, a true comparison. And that brings up two important issues. And one of the most important issues, I think, is one, standardization and the need for it. And two, the idea of a social and a private cost. So the idea with mattresses is that there's a private cost with getting a mattress. You might choose to buy the most fluffy, wonderful back-supporting mattress out there, and you might choose not to. And that's your private cost. Your private cost is what you decide to take on in order to enjoy that benefit. But there's also a social cost associated with that. You could make the argument that, you know, a bed that doesn't really support you that much has a low social cost. Yeah, you might wake up grumpy. Yeah, you might not get the best back support in the world. But on the whole, this isn't a huge issue for society. Now, you could say, well, okay, lower back injuries are a large portion of the population, and, you know, and that causes X amount of lost productivity a year, and that cost to the society is $15 million. Well, at some point, we have to make the decision, are mattresses so important to us that we need to either regulate them or standardize them or in some way reduce the social cost to everyone who gets to purchase beds, you know, or whoever, not even who gets to purchase bed, any participant in the marketplace. That is, maybe a manufacturer could say, well, gosh, you know, we work in a warehouse, and if our workers have bad backs, it's going to cost us X money of dollars of productivity a year. We're going to give them discounts in order to get, you know, Sealy mattresses because they're so fantastic, or Tempur-Pedic mattresses. Now, that's an individual company decision to undertake. As a society, it's hard to see any administration saying, man, we're going to give everybody a tax credit for a mattress. You know, the argument could be made with numbers, certainly, but the idea is that the social cost is such that we're willing to live with it. It's not that huge of an issue, and anybody with back problems out there, I apologize. I'm not trying to minimize your suffering. But at the same time, it's a social cost that we have as a society has said, you know what, it's tolerable. If you look at smoking, we've said, that's completely intolerable. Not only are we going to tax the bejesus out of cigarettes, we're also going to, you know, penalize the manufacturers for putting a product in the global stream of commerce that causes all sorts of headaches, not only for the states who must care for chronic smokers, but for individuals who are sufferers of secondhand smoke, or for children, or whatever it might be. So this issue of social cost is very important to enumerate. And because software is injected to more and more things, because software is networked more and more, the social cost isn't just national or even to your, you know, even localized to your region. It really becomes a global issue, because a problem in Ukraine or a problem in South China with a lot of insecure machines all of a sudden becomes the problem in the United States, or becomes the problem of Israel, becomes the problem of Brazil. You know, Estonia is a prime example of this. There's hundreds of thousands of machines all over the world that got hijacked by hackers and used in botnets. Now, of course, Estonia had no control over those machines, but those machines were used to leverage an attack, or used as an attacking mechanism against the country of Estonia. They absolutely felt the social cost of insecure software. So, you know, that's something that we not only as a nation have to decide how much we're going to tolerate, but as a global community, we have to, you know, how much we're going to tolerate as a global community. Much more difficult question to ask. I'm sorry, much more difficult answer to come up with. But again, it comes back to making that which is invisible visible, so that the market can somehow choose what they're willing to tolerate, other than just murky numbers, hyperbole on the part of some, underrepresentation on the part of others. You know, if you consider yourself a market participant or a buyer of information about security, not security itself, but information about security, it's really paltry. You don't have a lot of information to go on, and that really puts you at a disadvantage in any market. If you can't price something, if you don't know enough about something, you don't know if you're getting a good deal, and you also don't know about the costs that are being imposed on you by accepting that product. So it gets very difficult. But again, this becomes an issue. It's not something we haven't dealt with in previous lifetimes, previous industries, previous governments. We know the mechanism or the path. It's just, how do we get down that path in a way that benefits software manufacturers and consumers, and also helps, you know, everyone in the mix? We're not trying to punish software manufacturers, not trying to punish consumers. We are trying to put in incentives such that the social cost is reduced, but your private cost is, or your private benefit is also increased.
Good point. Earlier you talk about baselines and standards, and and around that you develop analogy around that via cement. And maybe you could, you know, expand for the listeners. What's the connection between between software and cement, and how are they? How do they have a lot more in common than you know, one might think?
Certainly. So when we look at infrastructure, one of the things that is always in front of us, but we might not always see, is cement. You know, our houses have it on our foundations, our roadways have it, our bridges have it. Almost any building you walk into has cement either in the foundation or potentially in the floors. If you walk into a high-rise building, you've got cement on every single floor. You've got it in the elevator shafts. Our airplanes land on cement. Our aqueducts that bring water to our cities are all made with cement. So cement is really considered one of those foundations of civilization. You can't have modern civilization without cement. Oh, you can have vestiges of it, certainly. You can have elements of it. But modern civilization, as we know it and see it and enjoy the benefits of it, really relies on cement. And that cement, since the late 1860s, has been Portland cement. And Portland cement is different than other types of cement. I won't go into the differences. But fundamentally, Portland cement has this remarkable capability of getting harder or stronger the longer it sets. So that means the cement poured in the Hoover Dam is still getting stronger every day. And that's a pretty amazing feature of it. Now, the issue with Portland cement, however, is if there's just a small, tiny variation in the mixing process and kiln temperatures, whatever it might be, whatever in the production process to the normal observer might appear as almost a trivial divergence, that can actually affect the reliability of Portland cement tremendously. So you have to get the manufacturing process of cement correct. Otherwise, that cement may fail on you at the most inopportune times and cause tragic events. Well, if we look at software, software also is really injected more and more into these devices and things that we have in our lives, but these things are creating, we would almost say, a virtual foundation, but I think that minimizes it too much. This is an actual foundation. Your business relies on IT. Your government, your state government, relies on software in order to process your benefits, in order to handle, you know, your claims, in order to do those things that states or entities or commercial bodies need to do. They have this stuff that works magic on this other magic called data. Now, that software is not only just limited, cement is limited to where it can be used, but software isn't. Really, as long as there's a microprocessor, a power source, and software to interact with it, you can put this microprocessor and the software in it anywhere you want, in a cell phone, in a car, in an airplane, in a water treatment facility, in an oil pipeline, in a ship, you name it, you can put it there. And in fact, we see that our devices are getting smarter and smarter and smarter. So we have a real foundation that our ships are relying on, and therefore the people that are driving the ship, and therefore the products that are on the ship. This stuff is all interconnected, and that software is critical to us. But like cement, any variation in the manufacturing process of software means that it may not act the way you want it to act when it actually goes into use. So just like cement, any variation in the production process may hurt the reliability of cement. The same thing can be said of software. A syntax error, you know, a boundary check that you forgot to do. All these small, tiny variations can result into potentially a worldwide exploit, something like Code Red or Slammer or any of the other massive worldwide events that we've had. You have this very tiny, some would say trivial foible in the software manufacturing process, yet it all of a sudden incurs at least $1 billion worth of damage someplace. So the reason why cement, I think, is a good analogy and / metaphor for understanding software is that small variations can have large effects. And nowhere is that more true than with software, especially when it's interconnected globally.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in to episode 3 of this podcast.